It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new candidate in the Democratic campaign for governor. How is that going to affect the race?
And now for something completely different.
What makes you think she's a witch?
Well, she turned me into a newt.
A newt.
I got better. Burn her anyway!
A clip there from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Our next guest claimed you can learn something about history, art, poetry, philosophy, the media, and almost everything else in life by watching Monty Python.
Together, Brian Cogan and Jeff Massey are the authors of the new book, Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python. They're both faculty at Molloy College in New York. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
And Jeff, great to have you with us.
Hey, thanks as well.
So why bother going to Molloy or any other college if we can learn everything from Monty Python? Why is this comedy so rich with actual commentary on life? Let's start with you, Jeff.
Well, the Pythons were a terribly learned bunch of guys. They came out of the Oxford-Cambridge sect. They really filled their comedy with a lot of depth, a lot of in-jokes, and a lot of very learned in-jokes that come across as kind of crass and vulgar when they're on stage, but on reflection, they really come across as having a lot to teach us.
And it sounds like one of the biggest threads running through their work is this anti-authoritarian ethos, where they pretty much knock down the institutions that we are supposed to take seriously, we brought up to take seriously. Why is that?
Well, I would think that when they came from sort of this post-war Cambridge and Oxford sort of milieu where people are questioning the British Empire and the idea that, like, you know, you're supposed to be a loyal subject, you're supposed to go to chapel, you're supposed to do this and that. And then they look around, they see the robes and they see the finery, and they go, oh my God, this is really, really silly. Why is no one making fun of this? And then they sort of, like, you know, they translate that to institutions like the news, where, for example, they're saying, like, you know, the regular news is just as silly as if we make it news for koala bears or news for parrots. And it sort of fits in with the idea that these things are incredibly silly social construction, and Python is just sort of pointing it out to us. And, I mean, me and Jeff have always wondered, why can't we have a ministry of silly walks?
Absolutely. And why can't I just teach Monty Python all the time instead of medieval literature?
Well, I wonder, you know, in some ways it's so uniquely British. I remember watching, and there were sometimes references to British politicians, media presenters, and yet it caught on really big, obviously, here in the United States, too. How did it cross the Atlantic, Brian?
Well, it actually started on Channel 13, that's our local station here, but on PBS, a station in Texas picked it up, and they got enormous ratings because the thing is that, you know, there are an enormous amount of geeks, including me and Jeff here, in America. And all of a sudden, we're watching shows like Python when it comes to New York and other states, and we're going, oh, my God, this is what we've been waiting for. This is real sort of like, well, we love comedy, but this is like, you know, this is comedy that takes no prisoners. Comedy that asks intelligent questions, and comedy that really has no patience for sacred cows. And we thought, like, this is what we were waiting for all those years.
It's interesting that they say one of the tragedies about Monty Python, though, is that nobody really followed up on it once they made their entrance onto the scene and made their mark. It sort of seemed like there was nowhere else to go with this thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, SNL tried to follow in line after them and had some success. And obviously they were very keen on the Pythons. They had them on their shows repeatedly. But the anarchic version of scheduling or of the format just did not really translate well afterwards.
We've got another clip from Monty Python and the Holy Grail here. In this one, King Arthur argues with a peasant who expresses some unmedieval political viewpoints. Let's give a listen.
Old woman!
Man!
Ma'am, sorry. What knight lives in that castle over there?
I'm 37.
What?
I'm 37. I'm not old.
Well, I can't just call you man.
You could say Dennis.
I didn't know you were called Dennis.
Well, you didn't bother to find out, did you?
I did say sorry about the old woman, but from behind you looked...
What I object to is you automatically treat me like an inferior.
Well, I am king.
Oh, king, eh? Very nice. And how'd you get that, eh? By exploiting the workers. By hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma, which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society.
Well, back to the theme of what we can learn from Monty Python. Jeff, the class system comes up a lot, not just in Holy Grail.
Oh, absolutely. And here we're getting one of those temporal mashups that essentially permeates all of Holy Grail. There are very few scenes in Monty Python and the Holy Grail that don't involve something from the Middle Ages shoved up against something from the modern era. And so here we get a sense of typical British, the king is the king because he's the king, up against modern Marxist theory. And they're playing up for jokes, but at the same time they're making us question why perhaps we still have a king anyway.
And it's something that it seemed like was particularly rich to them. And yet these were these guys who went to, you know, Oxford, for instance. These were sort of blue-blooded guys.
Absolutely.
Why did they decide to mine this particular vein so much?
I think because they knew this so well, or at least they of course, they had a smattering of everything, of Latin, of law, of medicine, of, you know, all these disciplines. And so they weren't afraid to just ask a question like, okay, what if, you know, we take a modern mediated environment like a sporting event and we apply that to writing a novel? So you have Thomas Hardy writing his novel. And of course, you have breathless commentators doing color play by play. It's a definite article. It's a Z. No, it's an Oh, my, this is an amazing, like, you know, new sentence from Thomas Hardy. And you kind of think, well, that's just as sort of ridiculous as interviewing a sports player after a game and, like, you know, well, we played really well and, you know, we came here to win.
Well, I don't want to knock your rendition there, but we actually have the original little clip of that. We can give a listen.
We can read
mine. And here he goes, the first word of Thomas Hardy's new novel at 10:35 on this very lovely morning. It's three letters, it's the definite article, and it's the Dennis.
Well, this is true to form. No surprises there. He started 5 of his 11 novels to date with a definite article. We've had 2 of them with it. There's been 1 but, 2 ats, 1 on, and a Dolores. Though that, of course, was never published.
I'm sorry to interrupt you there, Dennis, but he's crossed it out. Thomas Hardy here on the first day of his new novel has crossed out the only word he's written so far, and he's gazing off into space. Oh, dear, he's signed his name again.
It looks like Tessa de d'Urberville's all over again.
But he's down again and writing, Dennis. He's written the again. He's crossed it out again, and he's written A. And there's a second word coming up straight away, and it's sat. A sat. Doesn't make sense. A Saturday. It's a Saturday, and the crowd are loving it. They're really enjoying this novel.
So obviously a great sketch and a great premise. Thomas Hardy writing his novel in front of a stadium full of people who could, you know, in real life would have cared less to watch this guy writing. But what are we learning from that?
I think if you've never heard of Thomas Hardy before, and I didn't, I think, when I was 13 and hearing it for the first time, laughing anyway, that there was a guy named Thomas Hardy. He wrote some novels. One of them was probably Tess of D'Urberville's. And that somebody could treat him terribly, terribly seriously. And then we also start thinking about why it is, or we're questioning perhaps why we venerate sports figures and we don't venerate artists. It's equally ridiculous if we did, but why don't we? Why do we privilege one type of activity over the other as a group, as a mass of people?
Yeah, and to also think that, like, what we do is we're looking for heroes. And we usually look for people who excel at certain things. And to think that, you know, Hardy is doing sort of like the same kind of mental gymnastics as any novelist is or as any poet is. And they reference Eliot. They reference, you know, like Hardy. They reference, you know, all different, like, poets, artists, like, you know, different brands of theory. And we realize that, like, you know, these people could be heroic in their own way, too.
Absolutely.
A lot of times with popular culture, we look at, we see efforts to make it as inclusive as possible, to reach out to the widest audience possible. That wasn't their goal, it seems like, from the start.
No, not at all. This was a very, if you get the joke, congratulations, you're in the club. If you don't get the joke, that's the door. They didn't seem to really have a concern about, you know, gaining popularity.
And no, they didn't. They didn't really like punchlines either.
Absolutely. They're terribly against the idea of the punchline and the laugh track, for that matter.
And what if you don't get the joke? Does that mean you're just left out in the cold of their comedy, that you kind of have to have some prior knowledge even to laugh?
Well, in some ways, I always compare this to Bugs Bunny cartoons. I don't have to actually know anything about classical music to appreciate what Bugs Bunny is doing with it, if that resonates. Mm-hmm. And I think that much of what they do, even when they're name-dropping a ton of, you know, grade level 3 British authors, is still funny regardless. The idea of Thomas Hardy writing a novel and talking about definite articles and parts of speech, it's ludicrous on its own. Knowing about Hardy just gives it extra depth.
We're talking with Brian Cogan and Jeff Massey. They are co-authors of the new book, Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python.
And we want to hear from you on this one. What have you learned from Monty Python? Did watching the Pythons expand your understanding of the world, maybe teach you about a few things? And what is your favorite Monty Python moment and why? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about what we can learn from watching Monty Python's Flying Circus. Our guests are Brian Cogan and Jeff Massey. They're co-authors of the book, Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python.
And we're taking your calls right now. What have you learned from watching Monty Python? And did watching them make you understand the world a little bit better? Did it introduce you to new subjects and new people and new points of view? And what is your favorite Monty Python moment and why? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Darlene with us in Marshfield. Darlene, hi.
Hi.
What's your story?
I just called to tell you that we are avid Monty Python watchers, and as a third grader, my now 26-year-old daughter did her science project using the Galaxy Song from The Meaning of Life. We actually had to find the clip. We had been listening to it on the radio or in the car on a tape, and we found the clip, and then we had her practice all of the statistics that were listed, and during the rather adult scenes that you're probably familiar with, we made a big poster. We talked to our teacher, and she flipped the poster down over the screen so that the class wouldn't see that. And needless to say, she got an A, and today she works for public radio.
Well, good for her. That's a great story, Darlene. Thank you so much.
That's a great story.
Well, wow, what a great illustration. Jeff, let's start with you of somebody very literally taking what they learned from Monty Python mm-hmm. and using it in their education.
That's an awesome example, and I think that type of they might be giants in what current version of Monty Python songs like that. There's certainly stuff to be had in the middle of all of those sort of silly moments and some of the somewhat salacious ones. The Pythons were also very fond of synonymy in a lot of their songs, and so you can learn a lot about sexually transmitted diseases as well if you listen to some of their songs. Synonyms for dead, things like this, they pop up quite a bit. There's stuff to be had.
The parrot sketch is mostly synonyms for death.
Absolutely. 50%. Good euphemisms right there.
I don't remember the Galaxy songs. Can anyone sing a bar of it?
You guys, I don't remember the tune.
No, did I put you on the spot?
I'm not much of a singer.
We'll have to look it up. Yeah. All right, well, thanks a lot for the call, Darlene. Let's go to Brian in Madison. Hey, Brian, you're on the air.
One of my favorites, it was in the life of Brian, and it was the revolutionary group, the People's Front of Judea, or was it the Judean People's Front?
Splitters.
And they were talking about, what did the Romans ever do for us? Mm. And then one of
the roads.
The roads.
Well, there's the roads. You got that.
The lines. The aqueducts, you know.
Well, you got to give them the aqueducts. That's true. Stable government. Must do that.
Thanks a lot, Brian. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because you guys do write about that in your book. Brian, what do you learn from that?
One of the things that they were doing is part of Life of Brian was a parody, not just of sort of religious, like a sandal epics, but it was also sort of a parody of the waning days of the British Empire. And so you've got sort of the silliness of the British Empire deconstructed through that. And what they apparently, what we've read from like what Cleese said later was, he's looking at all those splitter groups as sort of like the way in which the British left wing were all split, like, you know, we're going to take down the government this way. No, that way. How about this way? And so no one could ever agree enough to take the Tory government out of power or really challenge it. And it's sort of like, you know, if you look at it through that lens, you're like, oh, wow, I'm learning so much about like the stuff I didn't know before. And even like Jeff's favorite, which is the Roman guard, like deconstructing Latin.
Awesome. Romana ita domum.
It's interesting because you're not just learning facts, it sounds like, what you're saying. People are learning a point of view by watching Monty Python. And it is sort of this, like we said, this anti-authoritarian point of view. So does Monty Python graduate a whole bunch of revolutionaries? Is that what happens?
I don't know if it's revolutionaries, but it's people who, I don't even want to use the word skeptic, but are against authority for its own sake. And I think that's the part with the thing you did before from Holy Grail. It's like, you know, like, what gave you the right to be the ruler? And he's like saying, what's the Lady of the Lake? Threw me this, like, you know, sword, and they're from the divine ruler. And he's like, really? Like, that's the best explanation you got as to why you're the king? And I think it's they're not necessarily saying, like, tear everything down, but it's saying...
But they are asking us to question everything.
Yes.
We'll go back.
That's a very healthy attitude.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Nico on the line in Green Bay. Nico, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up with Monty Python. I grew up with parents who were huge fans of Monty Python. I remember hiding behind, like, the couch or something when they would watch Monty Python so I could watch it when I was all of, like, 6 years old. And I just remember a lot of the humor from, like, Monty Python skits was, it felt like a lot of shows like Animaniacs when I was a little kid.
Oh, yes.
Kind of seemed to borrow from that. And so, like, a lot of children's cartoons would definitely, were definitely influenced by it, just the humor.
Jeff,
absolutely. Yeah, no, I'll say it's not just children's cartoon, although I loved Animaniacs as well, and you can clearly see in many of their songs a reflection of things like the Galaxy song. But modern cartoons now seem to be maybe the closest we have to a Python-esque type of humor, with the mashups and the non-continuities and the split from one scene to another. You've got Family Guy and South Park, essentially, and some early Simpsons, maybe.
Well, this next clip sets up a little bit of the continuity, I think. An interviewer's worst fear here a little bit. Let's give a listen.
Good evening. I have with me in the studio tonight one of the country's leading skin specialists, Raymond Luxury Yacht.
That's not my name.
I'm sorry, Raymond Luxury Yacht.
No, it's spelt Raymond Luxury Yacht, but it's pronounced Throat Wobbler Mangrove.
You're a very silly man, and I'm not going to interview you.
And a lot of skits ended with,
oh,
this is too silly, or the colonel walking in, I think it was a colonel saying, I'm going to stop this sketch, it's much too silly. They didn't worry, you mentioned earlier, about punchlines. They really played with the format of how they went from one thing to another.
Absolutely. Brian?
Yeah, it's one of those things where, okay, we've set up a premise, we've got it out there, we've thrown out, like, you know, the idea that you're on an interview show, like maybe this one, and all of a sudden I'm saying, my name is actually Brian Cogan. It is Brian Luxury Yacht. And everyone's like checking their notes. Oh, did we not do our research? Let's check the title of that book again for a second. And that's Jeff Yeklept Yemmer. And it's one of those things where, you know, sometimes the silliness is not from the authority figure. The silliness is from the person trying to break into this realm of authority.
True.
And so the guest himself could be just as silly as the interviewer.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's go to our callers again. We've got Kelly joining us now from Milwaukee. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I discovered Monty Python when I was in high school, and I will say that the philosopher's soccer match was what inspired me to learn more about philosophy. And as far as it's too difficult for me to find a favorite sketch, but I will say that I introduced my daughter, who's now six, when she was two, with the fish slapping dance. And that gets us laughing every single time, doesn't matter how many times you watch it.
Mm, that's fantastic. Thank you, Kelly. And you're inspiring me. We've just started sharing it with our kids, so the fish slapping is a good intro. What do you guys think about those two?
I think that's a great range she's got there.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
Well, fish slapping especially, you need no prior knowledge of anything to appreciate that.
No.
It is a sheer, unbridled, sort of like silly joy. It's just like, you know, is it a ritual? Is it like a hunting thing? Is it a mating ritual? But no, he's slapping the fish, and of course, the larger fish comes out.
And Michael Palin's favorite skit ever, by the way.
Really?
Yep, he said if they were remembered for nothing else, he wants to be remembered for the fish slapping skit.
All right, thanks a lot, Kelly, for that story. We've got Dennis on the line in Seymour now. Dennis, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I guess that Monty Python was my first exposure to humor other than American, and I realized that, you know, I guess funny is funny no matter where it comes from. And I also learned that I don't like spam.
Spam. Brian, universality of humor, he says he learned there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think Python is universal. By the way, we have a can of spam. actually, I did that. I brought that from Spam-A-Lot. And I have it, and it's on my sort of like my dresser at home, and I keep looking at it and thinking, the expiration date is way beyond where it should be eaten. At what point do I actually eat the spam? And that's been my sort of existential dilemma for the last 7 years or so.
You can always buy new spam.
No. That would be beside the point entirely. I have to risk it.
Is there actually new spam, or is it simply the same vat of spam in a new can?
Yeah, they put it in fresh cans, I think.
Is that it? Very efficient.
You know, in our last 30 seconds here, do you guys want to share your favorite of all time Monty Python sketch? Jeff, why don't you go first?
I'm a medievalist by trade, so I'm going to cop out and just say all of Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Okay, good choice. And Brian?
As a media studies person and a media ecologist, I have so many. The news for wombats is one. But one of the favorites is the interviewer with the sports star who has the monosyllabic answers and these long, like, involved questions. And that's like his answer is like, I'm opening a boutique, Brian. Or I've fallen off my chair, Brian. Or I kicked the ball, and then it was in the back of the net.
Nice impression. All right, it's been a lot of fun.
Better than that one.
All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
We've been speaking with Jeff Massey and Brian Cogan. Together, they're the co-authors of Everything I Needed to Know About Blank, I Learned from Monty Python.